Morantsev, born in Kiev and raised in England, the son of political exiles, moved to Moscow in 2006 to work in the fast-growing television industry. Telling the stories of the subjects of his TV programmes, he reveals the impact upon its people of Russia's sudden transformation from communist collapse to postmodern dictatorship. Justin Salinger reads, "Nothing is true and everything is possible."
Yana Yakovleva had been running the company since she was 20 with one other partner. Now she was 34. They had dozens of employees. It was the sort of company the general public rarely notice, but that makes good money, importing and reselling industrial cleaning fluids to factories and army bases. Yana came from a family of academic scientists, and now she made her money in the chemicals industry, Soviet knowledge transmuting smoothly to post-Soviet economics. She was at the gym when they came for her. The detective's name was Vasilkov. He had a face like a bulldog. "We are charging you with a particularly serious crime. Read this," he said, and handed her a folder. Inside were photocopies of her company's accounts and transactions, what they did normally every day. She couldn't understand. "You have been trading in diethyl ether," said Vasilkov. Diethyl ether was a chemical cleaning agent. Yana's company had built its business around it. It's an illegal narcotic substance. "But we have a license for it," answered Yana, almost laughing. "Since when was a cleaning agent used in every factory a narcotic substance?" Everything was starting to spin. Her synapses couldn't make sense of what was going on, a short circuit in logic. They drove her to Petrovka 38, Moscow's main police station. Yana had never seen so many cops in one place. They were leading criminals back and forth into cells, everywhere the sound of locks turning, keys jangling, doors slamming. Yana kept thinking of the Count of Monte Cristo. At court, they put her in a cage, on the accused stand. The judge looked matronly, with her hair in a bun and glasses. She looked like a sensible person. She would sort it out. "Well," said the judge. "I don't understand the charges," Yana began. She tried to sound authoritative, but as she spoke, she started to cry. It was just the absurdity of it all. The tears came from the effort to make sense of it. "I'm being charged with trading what I trade. It doesn't make sense." She was sobbing now. "All right," said the judge. "Prosecution?" The prosecutor was a man in a polyester suit. "Yana Yakovleva is a highly dangerous criminal. She has been hiding from us. We had to hunt her down. She needs to be put under arrest until the trial." What had he just said? Hiding? Where? At the gym? What were they talking about? The prosecutor just smiled at her. The judge nodded and repeated what he had said word for word and said no bail was granted. She would await trial in prison. The next hearing would be in 2 months. Everything was spinning again. The prosecutor walked up to Yana and whispered, "Bad girl, why did you hide from us?" "Black is white and white is black. There is no reality. Whatever they say is reality." Yana began to scream. The more Yana screamed, the more guilty she looked. She saw herself for a second, a redhead with red eyes, screaming in a cage in a courtroom. They took her prints. Her hands were covered with ink. She cried out for some soap. Some soap. They laughed at her. They put her in another police van and drove towards the prison. There was a small barred window at the back of the van, and through it Yana could see Moscow. It was the dead of night, and the streets were empty. She felt as if she were being smuggled, not just out of the city, but out of reality itself, into a nightmare fantasy land. Or was she just leaving the fantasy? We live in a world designed by the political technologists, a fragile reality show set. It's a simulacrum of the whole democratic thing. It feels almost real, but at the same time the other, real Russia, rumbles on like a distant ringing in the ears, and it can grab us, pull us in at any moment. There were 46 women in her cell, all packed together. It was like being in the subway at rush hour, but with no way out. In the far corner was a kitchen and a television playing MTV as loud as any nightclub. There were voices shouting, swearing, singing, laughing. Everyone was coughing. In the first days, she just wrote. She curled up in her bunk and wrote letters to her boyfriend, Alexei, love letters. They kept her sane. She wrote a letter to herself, a list of commandments. 1. Don't feel sorry for yourself. 2. Don't cry. 3. Don't think about your life on the outside. 4. Be patient. 5. Alexei will wait for you. He won't leave you. 6. Smile. 7. He loves you. In the following days, she began to look around the cell. On every bunk there was a micro-world. One woman was praying, another writing, another playing cards. Suddenly, a group of half a dozen women got up and went to a corner of the cell, stood in a little circle and began exercising. Squats, press-ups, abs. They looked like stumbling bears. They were doing everything wrong. Yana came up and asked whether she could join them. The next day she began to correct them, gently at first, just showing them how to do the exercises right. By the end of the week, she was their trainer. She began to get to know them. Her cell was for first-time offenders. Half were 20-something girls, virtually all in for drugs. They didn't know what to do with themselves. They didn't know how to have a proper conversation. They just watched MTV and TNT and gossiped. But when Yana talked to them, they all began to say how much they missed their parents. The other half of the women were in their 40s and accountants. The companies had been fiddling taxes, but the male bosses fled the country in time to avoid getting caught, and it was the female accountants who went to prison. After all, their signatures were on everything. It was Galia who first made Yana think there might be something bigger going on. She was a cashier at a pharmacy. One morning the FDCS, the Drug Enforcement Agency, had come and arrested Galia for selling food additives. "What's your name?" asked Galia. "Yana." "Yana Yakovleva." How could she know? "When I was arrested," Galia explained, "the cops were talking to each other and said I was being taken down under the same law as Yana Yakovleva. They're all talking about you." This was why Yana was in prison. When the young Putin moved to Moscow to become head of the FSB, the successor to the KGB, he took his friend Viktor Cherkasov with him, and Cherkasov became his deputy. After he became president, Putin gave Cherkasov the FDCS, the least important of the security organs. Starting in 2006, the FDCS launched a series of moves to capture the chemical and pharmaceutical industries. Overnight, a whole host of chemicals had their status changed from industrial or medical to narcotic. Pharmacies that traded in food additives were raided, and the heads of chemical companies like Yana were suddenly informed they were drug dealers. The plan was to break these industries. Yana was meant to swing from the gallows by the edge of the road, a warning to everyone of what would happen if they disagreed with the FDCS. Yana had a lawyer, Yevgeny Chernousov. His plan was to make so much fuss it would become unprofitable for the FDCS to hold Yana. This was the opposite to what most prisoners did, which was to keep the case as quiet as possible and pay off the right person. Yevgeny told Yana he would activate the human rights NGOs, business associations. He was a former cop himself, and he took on cases that no one else would. Yana's task was to stay sane. She had half a dozen fitness students. They would exercise in the morning and then again in the afternoon. One time she was exercising in the yard with a prisoner called Sasha. Yana told her about Alexei, about how she thought it was time to start a family. Sasha looked at her and said, "You're 35. It's too late for children. There's no way they'll give you less than 5 years. That's the very minimum. Once you're in here, that's it. It doesn't matter whether you're guilty. Forget about kids." Yana stopped listening and started doing star jumps so fast Sasha couldn't keep up. Her lawyer had told her they were writing letters to Duma deputies. There had been meetings and small pickets where human rights activists had defended her. But in Russia you can protest all you like, it won't change anything. Then one day, watching the news, she suddenly saw a report about herself. The reporter said, "The FDCS appears to be arresting people who have nothing to do with drug dealing at all." The next day, Yana's story was a spread in one of the newspapers. Cherkasov had enemies. He was trying to prove to the president that Patrushev, his rival and the head of the FSB, was a weak link. But Patrushev and the FSB were not going to go down easily. Just as Cherkasov was investigating Patrushev, so Patrushev supported those who were fighting Cherkasov. So when the FSB heard about Yana's story, they made sure the police didn't close down the demonstrations, that the right TV channels and newspapers covered the protests, and so Yana's case was allowed to be made. Cherkasov's men arrested the FSB generals involved in a Chinese border racket. In revenge, Patrushev's men arrested the FDCS's top generals right in the middle of an airport, surrounding them with masked gunmen and dragging them off to prison. The country's elites were split down the middle between those who backed Patrushev and those who backed Cherkasov. Where was the president? Could he not keep his own clans under control? Was he losing his grip? No, he was just waiting for his moment. Both men had compromised themselves. Cherkasov with the scandals around the FDCS, and Patrushev with the revelations about cross-border smuggling. Within 1 week, both were fired. In one swing, the president had got rid of two potential challengers. They had eaten each other up. Even the president's detractors could only step back and quietly applaud. On the day of her release, her lawyer drove Yana back to the flat she shared with Alexei. She knew their relationship was over. She made excuses for him. He was afraid she would come out emotionally damaged. "Ha," Yevgeny grunted. "Alexei's just a coward. Wouldn't even meet with me. He's afraid it might damage his career." Alexei was at the flat when she arrived. She gathered her things and put them into bags and waved goodbye as she left. She didn't show any emotion. She had dreamt of coming back to that flat. That's what kept her going. This was one final test, and maybe it was even the hardest. She passed it, with a quick smile as she waved goodbye. "Women always wait for men in jail," she told Yevgeny. "But men never wait. There's been research on it." Yana still officially runs her business, but she spends most of her time on an NGO she has set up called Business Solidarity, a sort of Good Samaritans for businesses who get into the same trouble she did. Sometimes she takes me along to the trials. The courtrooms are all brand new, with shiny bright tiles and high ceilings and lots of light. It's their modernity, their normality, that makes the actual trials so much more twisted. There are the little businessmen, all facing trumped-up charges, all with the same look of pure confusion, and Yana walks up to them and comforts them. They calm down when they see her. She brings, if not the hope for justice, then at least the promise of sanity.
Justin Salinger was reading Nothing is True and Everything is Possible by Peter Pomerantsev. The book is abridged by Robin Brooks and produced by Kirstine Cameron. Well, after the news, Woman's Hour discusses shredding, which apparently has nothing to do with cutting up pieces of paper.
I'm Julie, housewife. It's been 4 years since my last drink. Well, not counting all the relapses and that.
Sue Johnston, John Hannah and Paul Kay star in a comedy drama about recovering alcoholics.
All right, I'm Dano, alcoholic and all that. 3 years since my last drink and I got a job.
Hey.
Now, hold on, then I lost the job. Well, that's cool because I hated the boss.
Love in Recovery continues every Wednesday evening at 11:15 and you can hear all the episodes on the BBC Radio 4 website.